Hey everybody, Tony Giuliano, host of the No Code Podcast. I'm really excited to bring you Season 1, Episode 8 with my guest today, Min Park. Min is an all-around great guy. He's a global head of marketing for an international genotherapy company. He works on several nonprofit boards. He and I are teaming up right now to benefit PhilAbundance in the greater Philadelphia region, raising money and donations for people in need. And Min has a great story about immigrating from South Korea when he was about 8 years old to the United States, not knowing the language, and building an incredible life and career for himself. I'm really excited for this one and hope you guys enjoy the podcast. Hello, Min.
Hello, Tony. How are you?
Good. How are you doing this lovely Monday morning?
It's a holiday coming up around the horizon, so can't complain, right?
Yeah. You're really screwing me up here, by the way. I usually record Friday afternoons, and now you throw this Monday morning curveball at me. I'm like, you know, I'm still in the midst of my coffee. I'm looking at all the calendar stuff I have for the rest of the week. I mean, you really got me here.
You know, only because I figure Friday, where I got work going on, but you know, this whole week I took off the rest of the week, so why not do it on Monday?
There you go. It's all good. I actually kind of like the vibe because I'm like, you know, I got the coffee going, I'm energized. Sometimes these Friday afternoon podcasts, I'm a little spent from the week by then, you know?
Yeah, I hear you on that one. Friday's it's a home stretch game there.
Yeah. Well, listen, I really appreciate you jumping on today. And for all the listeners out there, this is Season 1, Episode 8 of the No Code Podcast. And my guest is Min Park. Min is a head of marketing for a large global genotherapy firm. He's a board member of NAP, the National Asian American Association for Professionals in Philadelphia. And he's got a great story of his life and career and coming to the United States and launching a great success story for himself, and really happy to have you on today.
I appreciate, you know, inviting me on. This is, I heard your other episodes, so you have great folks coming on board, and definitely looking forward to sharing a lot of the stories.
Yeah, absolutely. So listen, let's get right to it. So you're the first immigrant on the No Code Podcast. So I'm bestowing that honor onto you. And I'm very curious to hear, because I haven't yet, even in our, you know, pre-call conversations, of, you know, what your backstory is in terms of, you know, where you came over to the United States from, how that all went down, you know, maybe some of the, I'm sure there was a lot of challenges along the way in evolving and understanding the culture here, and just very interested to have the listeners hear about it.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. I mean, I must say, wow, this goes back a very long time. So I spent, you know, many, many years here in the stateside. But yeah, I was born in South Korea, you know, in the late 70s, and immigrating here in the, I would say, late 80s. I was probably 8 years old around that time. But I think that's a whole totally different discussion over the actual details about these journeys, because I think it's always a great story coming in here. But, you know, things that I would say coming into the U.S., you know, being thrown into an education system, which is far different than, you know, what it was in Korea growing up, and right. Not knowing, you know, I would say a lick of English, right?
Right.
So, and that was a very, very difficult time. I would say, like any immigrants, nothing new for me and nothing new for anybody else going through the same journey. But I would say around just not knowing English and being thrown into third grade, I remember, you know, being in an environment, which I think it was, you know, probably very little Asians, I should say, like myself, right, in there. They had ESL classes, and they have all special classes for other language that they could support. But I think the teachers, they did, you know, everything above and beyond they can within the limitation to figure out how do we take, you know, these two Korean kids, which is my brother and myself, being thrown into this public school system, you know, third and fourth grade, and you know, looking like a deer in a headlight.
Right. And that's a tough time to come over, because I mean, by that point, you know, it's not like you're four or five and,
yeah,
you know, you're still learning your ABCs and how to form, you know, coherent sentences. By third grade, everybody's, you know, pretty much reading and writing at a pretty good level. And,
yeah,
you know, to come in not knowing any English at all, I would imagine was a really, really tough challenge.
Yeah, and you know, it's where I remember just sitting in the back of the classroom going to school every day and just not, I know they're talking, but I couldn't figure out what they're talking about. You know, you kind of make
Right.
sense out of it. But man, when I tell you, Tony, when it came to math,
Tore it up.
I whipped out my abacus, which is, you know, my toy. One of the things the only thing I pretty much brought with me was my abacus, because we use abacus in South, you know, in Korea, you know, when I was a child. And
Right.
it was also a toy, right? If you flip that abacus upside down, it's like mega wheels. So I remember whipping that abacus out of the back of the classroom, and I finished that math like, I don't know, give me like 60 seconds, I finished the entire sheet.
You taught them a thing or two on the
Oh,
math
I
front.
mean, I remember the math, and I was like, wow, okay, I learned this, you know, not in third grade. I mean, I learned this probably in my first grade, you know, in Korea, and I finished that. I mean, I aced math when I came here,
Right.
and that goes to show it's a universal language, right?
Right.
I mean, it just to me was a cake, and I accomplished. I got an A in that, but man, I can only. I mean, you want to guess what I got in every other subject?
Maybe not A's,
I
but
got total F
understandable.
along the entire time. I got F straight down the line, and I got an A plus in math. Go figure, right?
Well, at least that showed, your strong suit at the time, and also that, you had the ability to comprehend things, and that obviously it's the whole language thing. You got to catch up in that regard, which I can't imagine if you drop me in another country right now. I mean, I took, 5 years of Spanish between high school and college, and I could get by on a very simple, slow, straightforward conversation, but drop me in another country where I don't know the language, and I don't think it'd be that easy,
Oh, but you know, and I always think back and I look at it where it was like, as difficult as it was for us, you gotta look at, you know, parents, right? I mean, I look at my parents,
Sure.
my mom and dad. I mean, God, they didn't even have a job, they have nothing, and if you had nothing in Korea, very minimal to nothing, and coming here and bringing two kids, I mean, wow, that just,
Yeah.
this is the earlier generation of immigrants, you know, and my parents are not alone in that, right? I mean, anybody
Yeah.
immigrant that bring their family over for the first time, that is just some serious level of you know, iron heart, you know, and
Yeah, it's
keeping
and
it
it's a huge
together.
sacrifice too, because they're I assume I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I assume they're doing it mainly to give you and you said your brother, right?
Yeah,
A
absolutely.
better life and a chance at more success. I mean, I have somebody that in high school I was very close with, and through college and into adulthood, that immigrated from Peru when he was 5 and his sister was about 2 or 3. And all going through high school, you'd go over to their house, and their parents did not speak any English at all. And they worked in the casino industry, and they had jobs that were not glamorous by any means. They were very, very hardworking people, but they did it all for their kids. And then my friend wound up going to James Madison University and graduating from there, and now he's doing great in the finance world, and his sister's doing really well too. And they gave it up. They gave it up for their kids to just say, "Hey, we're going to come here and grind it out while you guys have a chance to flourish."
Yeah, and I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, I always tell my parents, you know, the biggest gift that they have ever given myself, I'm sure my brother feels the same as well. I mean, the biggest gift, I mean, forget the birthday gifts, right? Forget all
Right.
that stuff and the Christmas. But I said the biggest gift that they have given, you know, myself and my brother, I mean, it is literally bringing us here, right? I mean, the
Right.
opportunities and the education, the life that we have today. I mean, God, I mean, this is something that, you know, I don't think it would have been a lot more difficult to obtain, you know, without opportunities during that time frame. It was a very difficult time. So, and you know, I'd say they had a, you know, much bigger challenge, right? Because I mean, not only they have to survive, but for the kids and everything else, they have to, you know, put food on our table, right? And put clothes on our
Right.
table and everything else. But at the same time, you also go through that phase, you know, being an immigrant child, I guess I should say, it's very difficult because your parents are working pretty much 7 days a week, right?
Sure,
So you got to grow up pretty quick yourself,
right.
not as a child. And I think that's one of the things that I really helped me who I am today, I believe, because my brother and I mean, we grew up pretty much together. I mean, we have such a strong bond because we have to survive together, right? You have to go through school together. We have to go through life together. And I think that really put us in a different world together on that. And I mean, he is my best friend, right? And right. He's my brother. I mean, and love the guy to death, and nothing I would ever do for him. But we have a, you know, I would say it's a very special relationship because of the journey that we have commonly shared. Along with that, and I would say he shared the same journey as me because both of us went to the same school system, third or fourth grade. Not, yeah. You know, word of English, but you know, this goes back to around some of the, you know, things that I've come to realize where, you know, as I get older and start thinking and looking back in that journey and start thinking, okay, there are so many people, and people are amazing and people are so beautiful in so many different ways where they go out of their ways for others, right? And I think that itself, it is, you know, it brings goosebumps to me when I think back of that. And I didn't think of it at the time. But, you know, as I think back, I mean, not, you know, failing everything, I had, a few people who had, I would say, life-changing impact. And when you think about these life-changing impact, I mean, you got to exclude your parents. Of course, they're going to have a life-changing impact, right? I mean, I'm talking about people who are out of your norm. I would say they're probably less than five people. You could probably count them less in one hand, right? I mean, if you go through, some people might go through maybe one or two people in their life of having somebody who's going to really have that impact in your life. I would say, you know, I had two right away, which is amazing. And growing up in third grade there in that environment, I mean, I had a faculty member. He's one of, I would say, one of two that I had in my life that really had a huge impact. Of, you know, getting me to where I am today is this gentleman was a faculty. I don't recall him even being a teacher, but he'd come to realize that, you know, you had two Korean kids that you just, the school system just didn't struggled with and they didn't know what to do. And he literally pulled us out of the school year and said, let me have these two boys and let me try to teach them English from basics, from ABCs, right? I don't recall him being a kindergarten teacher. I don't recall him being, you know, first grade teacher. I think he's just a faculty member that was there. But man, I mean, he wasn't, I mean, I don't know if he was an educator. I have no idea. But one thing I do know for a fact is that his heart was, you know, above normal,
right?
to take us on to say, I remember him going on, like, I don't know, PC Richards or wherever, like bringing it, you know, lugging in these big, humongous refrigerator cargo box into the school, into his office, and cutting it out like it's an immigration box. Like, you know, he would walk up to it, like, oh, you know, welcome to the United States, you know, what's your name? And he taught us ABCs, what's your name? I'm a boy, there's a cat, you know, basics, right?
Wow.
So it was just within a year, it took us 1 year, we were thrown right back into the school system. He taught us English. Caught us from probably kindergarten, you know, English, to got us back onto third and fourth grade right away, within a year, right? So that was a transformation, right? For somebody to take their time and look after us every day in class and work with us. And, you know, I mean, I would love one of his, you know, family members to hear. I mean, his name is Mr. Francesi, and he was in West New York. Oh, my God. I mean, and God bless his soul. His family. I mean, he was one of those people who had a huge, huge impact in teaching us English and getting us started, which we direly needed at the time. You know, I would say, I mean, it's amazing. We're people like that. And those are the people I'm talking about where they had an impact, you know, outside of your parents. Of course, it would always have an impact, right? So, I mean, anybody like that in your life, you know, Tony?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And, you know, first of all, anybody that does that is a special kind of person to go above and beyond, you know, whatever their job was. And like you said, you're not even sure exactly what his job was. You just know he was involved in the school somehow. And he saw a couple kids that maybe were struggling due to the circumstances of not knowing the language. And he steps in and just total self-sacrifice to teach you guys the language. And that's incredible. And for me, you know, similarly, it was teachers and coaches in sports growing up, you know, that, and lucky for me, there's been a lot of them. One in particular was a second grade teacher of mine, Mrs. Connolly, who I believe passed away a couple years ago, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh.
And, you know, I was a pretty good student early on, but I was extremely shy. And, you know, when I was 4 years old, my parents split up. And I think early in life that caused, you know, I don't think I identified it at the time, but I think it caused, you know, a lot of stress and anxiety. Yeah. And I, you know, I went to kindergarten and, you know, first grade. And I don't think I was identified as a very strong student because I was so shy and I was so withdrawn. And, you know, she saw potential in me, and, you know, they were thinking about actually placing me in some, you know, some remedial classes for kids that just needed a little help or were learning at a slower basis. And my dad went in, to his credit, and said, listen, I talk to this kid all the time. You know, he seems like he knows what he's doing. You know, why don't we work with him and figure something out? And they, and, you know, to her credit, Mrs. Connolly, they arranged for me to go take some aptitude tests, and they came back really strong. And it was identified like, okay, he needs to come out of his shell, mm-hmm. you know? And now I'm 38 and hosting a podcast. So I guess I came out of my shell. I don't know, but
I think so.
but she had that nurturing care and support that, and she helped me in class kind of bring it out too.
Yeah.
You know, and then by the time I was in third grade, fourth grade, I wouldn't shut up. You know, then the problem was I talked too much, you know? You know, somebody like that was really special to me. And I always remember what she did. And then I was lucky enough, her son became an assistant soccer coach for me in high school too. And he was he's a phenomenal guy. Another great person. But then, then fast forward a few years into high school, I was a baseball player, wound up playing in college, as did my brother, Paul. Mm-hmm. And so we were always working out, always training in the winter. My dad got us into an indoor facility with a couple coaches. One is a guy by the name of Bobby Woods, and he played in the Chicago Cubs organization. Mm-hmm. And another guy, his best friend, and they coached a community college together down there, a guy by the name of Lefty Deber. And we went to them for private instruction. And we also worked in their summer camp. They did a summer camp that would travel around Southern New Jersey area in the summer. And that was our first jobs for my brother and I. And the stuff that they taught us on the baseball field was great from a technical standpoint, but the quality of their character was just unbelievable. And Bobby was like half a stoner hippie and great baseball player. So, you know, he taught us how to relax. He taught us how to, you know, not with any substances, but just how to relax, you know, how to get the mental focus. And I tell this to a lot of people. One trick he taught me that I sort of apply to my life in different ways is, you know, we'd be taking batting practice and we do it a lot. I mean, pretty strenuous. We might be 40, 50 swings in, and you get tired and you start to lose focus and, you know, then you're not doing so well. He'd stop and he'd say, hey, Tone, and I'm a right-handed hitter. He's like, go take some swings left-handed.
That's right.
And I go up there, and, you know, I can't even hit it. And like, it's a mess. He's like, all right, go back right-handed after about five. And then, you know, line drive. Sometimes you need to step out of your comfort zone in order to lock back in, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, those kind of things, I'm eternally grateful for those teachers and coaches and everybody needs that. 'Cause you know, we'd all like to say we're self-made people, but nobody becomes successful without good mentors and people you can lean on.
No, you nailed it on that one. I mean, you're absolutely right because of the fact that, you know, it's the environment that, you know, we get thrown into, and things learn along the way. But yeah, I mean, the unlimited amount of thankfulness to people in our education system, right? I mean, the coaches volunteering, the volunteers and so forth. And you look at so many things that go on every day around our kids, our future generation, right? And the environment that they're growing up versus what we grew up in, right? I mean, it's way different, right? And sometimes you wonder if our kids are going to grow up in an environment, they're going to miss out these opportunities to learn lifelong lessons,
right?
You harbor them and so forth, right? So you got to get your kids out. You got to get them out of the comfort zone. You gotta, get them, experience things that we somewhat experience, at a controlled manner. But yeah, I mean, talking about experience, I would say another person who really had an impact on my life was a gentleman that got me introduced to Cub Scout.
Okay.
Coming to the U.S., yeah. I'm like, what the hell is Cub Scout? Right? What is Boy Scout? I have no idea. All I knew is that my parents work 7 days a week, and I saw them at dinner, and we had so much time. And I think one of the gentlemen saw my brother and myself saying, these kids kind of lost.
Right.
They're speaking English now. I can actually talk to these two boys and see what they're doing, but they're just completely lost,
right.
When you're in elementary school, you take pictures, right? Classroom pictures and so forth. I mean, wow. I mean, those pictures of stuff that I try to bury because I mean, not having a lot of proper clothes, I should say, right?
Right.
And these things are, all right. And this gentleman, he was a janitor at the school.
Was
Pat Callahan, another saint. And he introduced my brother and I to Cub Scout, and boy, talk about an eye-opening experience. And going back to the experience, lifelong lessons, we got hooked on the Cub Scout and what they did. And even till today, what I learned about life lessons being to be prepared. I mean, I have a plan A, plan B, and, I'll have to plan, probably plan M. Nothing goes wrong, but that's just the way I live and the way who I am is because of what I learned in that Cub Scout and Boy Scout, in that environment.
Right.
And he is the one that introduced us to it and got us involved with it. I mean, he didn't have to whatsoever, but I mean, he was so active in that as a scoutmaster and so forth, and Cub Scoutmaster as well, really taught us beyond just our language, right? I mean, that fundamental development that we lacked coming in, we could have got lost very quickly. Now the fact that we learn English and pretty much roaming with nothing, no extra curriculum, nothing to do. But he got us really honed in and focused on that, and having that outdoor life, camping and everything else. I would say, yeah, I mean, it was amazing. And one of the things I would never forget, I think it was my eighth grade year. And I guess I didn't know if a lot of these classroom pictures, I guess if you take it, your parents don't buy it. What happens to them, right? I had no idea.
Right.
We just never bought it because we didn't have it.
They just go into an abyss of,
Or they go to trash.
They go to trash, yeah.
No idea. Pat Callahan, I think it was like eighth grade, right before I graduated, I remember he was like, here, come see me. I said, fine. I went to go see him. He handed me, my brother and myself, our classroom pictures from third grade. Never threw them away because we were in Cub Scout together, right, and everything else. He saved them. Right. Never bought it, right? He gave us pictures from third grade all to eighth grade. I mean, tears to my eye. Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing. I mean, it's so great to hear people that do that so selflessly, and they just... somebody just looking out for you, somebody that probably saw that, maybe you guys were not living the comfortable suburban life that maybe a lot of your other classmates were.
Yeah.
And saying, hey, I'm going to look out for these kids and I'm going to make sure that they get to enjoy what other people do too. And that's, that's something to really value and appreciate, because, looking back growing up and when you're a kid, I don't think you really think about this stuff because, you're just going out and, and you're worried about who's playing basketball at recess and, what movie you're going to go to Friday night with your friends. Like you don't think about stuff like this, but there are plenty of people that grow up differently than you, and it might not always show, but when you hear about something like this, it really highlights that the fact that there are these, even in suburbia, these major differences, and certainly in urban environments, even more pronounced. Yeah. So,
I mean, it's one of those things you think back and you come to realize you don't have to have, it would be great if you could have impact in so many people's lives, right? But you can have these one or two impacts that define people in the future, right? And you don't know it at the time, right? But it goes to show that you have to literally think and stop. I know we all live in a fast lane. We all live a busy life, right? We all got families and everything else. It gets even busier. I get it, right?
Yeah.
But it's stuff like this that grounds you and grounds me, and start, and you know, it makes me stop and think, all right, what do I need to pause, because everything's going so fast and so quick. What do I need to do? And you pause and you start thinking, what if I can have an impact, and if I can give back in so many ways, it's the time to do it. Because right. You know, I always tell everybody, when you know, you can only give when you have something to give, right?
Sure.
Of course, everybody wants to give, but it's more difficult when you don't. So when you have these opportunities to give and to have an impact, you got to pause and stop. And you know, and I always tell myself, when I see people on the side of the road, I mean, yeah, I can't stop for everybody, but you know, if I see, you know, somebody stranded on the side, I mean, I might just want to pull over one day.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
If it has a light on and say, are you okay? They might say fine. And you drive on. Right. But you just never know. Right. And these are things that, as a human to human, and a person to person, to really stop, you know, and think beyond yourself and beyond, you know, and you got to lift up people when you have the ability to do it. And you don't have to have much to do it, right? I mean, I could tell Mr. Francesi and Mr. Callahan, these two that had an amazing impact in my life, they didn't have to do it. And I'm sure they weren't making any six figures either.
Sure. Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
But it is, and it's that time. That time is so precious. And the time you put effort into others, you know, could have a huge impact. And that's priceless, I should say.
Yeah. And I think, you know, something you said earlier about, you know, giving from a position of where you have more to give, that's a great concept. And I think now, as I'm in my late 30s, I feel that more than when I was in my late 20s and early 30s. And it's part of what drives me today in my own success and career and financially, is that I want to give back. I want to help people that can't help themselves. Mm-hmm. And certainly you help. I've helped along the way. I mean, there were times where I didn't have much in the bank, and I still would give that, that 10 bucks, that 20 bucks, or my time when I could. And that's the other big thing you mentioned too, is that you don't have to just give financially. You can give your time. You know, you can go out and help different organizations. And, you know, my wife and I have been active with, you know, different animal rescue organizations. Mm-hmm. We've been horse rescue. We've been, you know, women that have suffered abuse and things like that. We've volunteered our time. But now, as we grow in our careers, you know, we can volunteer both the time and the money and make an impact. You know, and I think that should be a driving force for a lot of people. It's not like you want to make it big in business and financially just to hoard your cash. Like, you want to make the world a better place.
Absolutely and
that's what we're trying to do. And you know, I think that's, maybe it's a good time to mention what you and I are doing, partnering up for Phil Abundance via NAP and via JLL, if you see my little segue right there.
Yeah absolutely. I love that plug-in. I mean as I get involved with NAP and serving as their board member and so forth, I mean, we couldn't partner up with somebody as great as Phil Abundance. And the cause that they do, and amazing how many, I think they feed about 90,000 people weekly, right? I mean, it's like, it's mind blowing, right? And
right.
During COVID now, during the crisis, they're in more need than ever. People need more than ever. People are losing jobs, right, today and so forth. And there's so much more need and so much more hunger. And hunger is already a problem to begin with, right? Now it's even worse, compounding that to it. And this is kind of why we partnered up with Phil Abundance, with NAP. And again, I'm here, we're raising funds. We're doing fundraising, and then we're, you know, 100% of the donation and the proceed goes towards Phil Abundance. You know, NAP as an organization, we don't take any salary whatsoever, right?
Right.
Purely a volunteer, base. But we're having, you know, uber fun with probably, I think we have like seven teams that are all out there. And, you know, obviously my team is the best, the Park Train.
That's right. Park Train.
So thank you, Tony, for joining my team there. And we're doing it together, and hopping on board, the winning team, I should say.
Absolutely.
And I would definitely, you know, ask all the listeners, to, you know, to donate. It doesn't have to, it could be $5. It could be anything. But most importantly, even the fact that we can get this awareness of how many people
are
hungry, that alone is a huge value, right? I mean, that to me is even, you know, that's a baseline that I want everybody to be understanding. Sure. How many people out there go hungry, and how we can make an impact in that. And if you want to, you know, if you are able to, yeah, make a financial donation. And it is also 100% tax deductible.
there you go.
Make it to the Park Train donation here. I think, Tony, if you can, you know, add that little link to your listeners.
I will.
Easy click of a button, go there and donate. And we're going to, you know, bring this together. We're going to help fill abundance and feed more people and bring more food to them. We have huge amount of corporate sponsors and partners vested into it. And individually, we're so vested in it. We're so passionately about what the impact that we can make here. So, yeah, I would say this is a piece, right? We can all give back. And when we can, or just spread the word, and that's okay.
Sure, yeah. I mean, you think about the multiplier effect, yeah, of the funds raised plus the awareness. I mean, that's a big deal, and the dollar goes really far with Phil Abundance too.
No.
Like even a small donation can really provide a lot of meals to a lot of people. So I mean, that's a huge part of it too. So if anybody's listening, you know, go to philabundance.org and search the Park Train team. But we will post the link as well.
Yeah.
When I share this podcast out on LinkedIn and when I put it on my just my summary of Spotify and Google and Apple and wherever you get your podcasts, the link will be there.
Sounds great. Sounds awesome.
So that's important, and we got a great event coming up at the Navy Yard on December 12th, and you know, it's a big drive of donations and non-perishable food items, so that's exciting. But you know, one thing I want to talk about now too, man, is you know, you talked about a lot of people that have helped you in your life, yeah, and the lessons you've learned. How have you been able to take those lessons and apply it to your job and your team and your marketing efforts with your firm? You know, whether currently or other stops along the way in your career, because, you know, one thing you may not know about me is that I was a marketing minor in college. And I also, my dad is chief marketing officer of Bally's, which is formerly Twin River Worldwide Holdings. They just bought Bally's in Atlantic City and rebranded the whole company.
Excellent.
So I've got marketing in my DNA.
That's right.
I think marketing is the engine that powers the machine. You know, I probably shouldn't say that to my finance and operations colleagues, but, you know, I think marketing is pretty damn important in understanding, you know, who are your customers, how do we get to them? And it's a never ending battle. It's a grind.
No, and you know? I think you just nailed it right there. And one thing I could always talk about is, you know, it's about the customer journey. It's, you know,
right,
you got to understand your customers. If you don't understand your customer, you could have the greatest product, right? But if you don't understand your customer and the need and what the value brings to them, what good is it? Right. So,
right.
And I think that's really more of the basis of it, to where, you know, I looked at my career and looked at all the companies I've been to and look at all the competitive market space. You know, everybody goes, you know, to that initial reaction, that gut reaction is, oh, I have to compete. I have to compete. I have to be competitive. Right. And right, of course, that's the default that everybody takes. But if you're strategic enough, you can see the bigger picture of it too. Is, you know, why are you going to compete in that space? You know, with, you know, if you have less means as well, right? I mean, you could have all the means, or you could, might not. I don't know. But at the end of the day, it's, you got to think outside of the box, right? And thinking outside of the box is, you know, change the game, right? Change the game altogether. Right. Then your competitor have to pivot to your game, which is a whole new different game, right? So instead of trying to compete with them on that, but going back to the original question is that you can only do that if you understand your customer, right? And you got to understand what your customer face, what your customer's pain points are, as well as what they go through your organization, right? From the point of first hearing, learning about your organization, you know, and to all the way through that journey of that buying cycle journey, right? Mm-hmm. And then experience, yep, once they bought into it, what does that experience look like? And how you change that, as well as, you know, it's just all around. I would say what I learned around, again, my passion around just understanding people, understanding the nature, I think helps a lot. But just in terms of the business sense, you know, it's just a matter of doing better, right? And
right,
you can spend all the money you like, but man, if you can get your organization to do better, that alone is a huge gain. Huge competitive gain, right? Because you figure all the organizations probably going through the same pain points as any of us are. But man, if you can get your sales and marketing team together and work better, I mean, it's always a chicken and the egg, right? What came first? What goes first? Marketing or sales, right? You can debate that all day long, but you have to, what you cannot debate about is you have to get the team as one organization and see it as a whole. And doing that better, it's going to have such a competitive edge, right? And that translates down to what that customer journey is, that positive customer journey that they're going to go through, right? And talking to those customers that really need that attention and be ready for it, right? I mean, it's all the analytics and the metrics. I mean, so much data that goes into it that, that you know, I will say many dismiss, but there's so much information, so much data that you can go through to really help drive your business day in, day out. But yeah, I would say it's just customer journey. I think you nailed it right from the beginning of that question.
Yeah. Sorry to steal your thunder there. You know, I am a marketing genius and I know you're trying to catch up here. So.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I am. But I do want to visit your, you know, the casino.
Yeah, definitely. Well, you know what's funny about that? So you may be aware of this. Asian marketing in the casinos is a huge business.
Huge.
So my dad took me to a dinner one year. This is probably about 10 years ago, maybe more, 10, 12 years ago. And he was running marketing for Resorts and Hilton in Atlantic City that used to be owned by the same company. And he asked me one night, he was going to this Chinese restaurant in Pleasantville, New Jersey, right outside of Atlantic City, which is not the greatest area. And this restaurant was sort of in the middle of a strip mall. And I pulled up. I'm like, oh, this looks a little, you know, a little sketchy. I drive in there and it's this big place and the food is unbelievable. And I sit down and there's this table of like 20 people. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is your Asian marketing team? And they had one or two representatives from like each part of that region. And there was different dialects of Chinese and there's a Korean guy. And, you know, so went around the table and it was around New Year's. And so it was like their New Year's celebration. And he had everybody say Happy New Year in their own language. Mm-hmm. And it got to the Korean guy. And I don't know if this is correct or not, but his Happy New Year was like four sentences long, where everybody else's was like two words. and he would say it and then crack up. And the whole table would just laugh. So I don't know. Great. I could be remembering that incorrectly, but I don't know. It was pretty funny.
Yeah, no, and it's great that they actually get together, right? I mean,
oh yeah, and it was a great party. Everybody was having a blast. But anyway, that's just
sounds like your dad knows exactly what he's doing.
He knows. He knows what he's doing. Keep that group staffed up and well paid, and keep them.
And you know, his success is his team too, right? So getting them together, right? And you know, that team building, team bonding is so critical. And I know it's we all sit in at a busy time, but you got to get your sales and marketing team together, right? I mean, it's.
Yeah,
it's so important. Get on the same page with what he does. So yeah, I would say that. I was gonna say, I was like, let me know what casino that is. I'll definitely.
Yeah,
you might find me on a blackjack table or baccarat.
There you go. I'll make sure you get the proper treatment.
That's right.
But
I'll stay out of the system though.
Oh man, I want to jump back to one thing you said though on the analytics side. So one thing. My opinion about marketing is that, you know, there might be this outward perception that, you know, if you're a marketing person, you're not a finance person or you're not a numbers person. Like it's more art than science. But what I've seen in my organization now, and also, like I said, the casino business that I'm very familiar with through my dad and brother, is that you better be on point with both. And it's as much a science as it is an art in terms of not only understanding the customer experience, like you said, but how to maximize that group, like how to bucket your different customers, how to go after them from a communication and promotion standpoint, and how to keep them coming back. Because it is very much, I think, to do it right, analytics driven.
No, you know, and numbers don't lie and data don't lie, right? I mean, there's a lot of information you can digest so many different ways. As long as you have the information and analytics, but you know, even going back, you know, step even further back from that, when you look at sales and marketing team, one of my big philosophy growing up and you know, in the career industry that I'm in, I mean, It's amazing how many salespeople are salespeople, how many marketing people are marketing people, right? But it's you're so tied together that an effective marketer has to understand the sales side of it, right? They have to understand the customer journey and everything else. That's, you know, the sales cycle, what the sales team go through and every day and so forth. You have to understand the sales cycle. And it goes vice versa for the sales team, right? The sales team is so busy on trying to sell. You know, you got to understand the marketing aspect of it. Why are you selling? Who are you selling to? You know, who are your ideal customer? Who are your sweet spots, as well as who are the ones that's really going to have a positive outcome because what you're offering absolutely meets what you're trying to sell to, right? It alleviates the pain point, right? Those are the ideal customers and so forth. So I think it's vice versa. You have to know the other, one or the other. I mean, I've done both business development and marketing, right? And me, that is a huge lesson for me along, you know, my career development, right? And I implore that to everybody, even my marketing team right now. I try to get them in front of, plug them into the sales organization as much as we can, right? And I ask the sales team, hey, take one of my marketing managers out there with you when you can, right? And at the same time, I tell the sales team, you got to understand the marketing, because you can sell everything and anything, and I have no doubt about it. And you're probably successful at it, but you have to know what you're selling, why you're selling it, and you know what we want you to sell with it too, right? So it has an operational impact when you sell the wrong things, right? So there's a lot of things that really comes together in that, but a lot of the analytics and the data loops into that, right? To understand, you know, what is there to sell, right? I mean, the last thing I want to see is my marketing team, you know, positioning and generating awareness as well as creating the demand generation for something that we might be sold out of, right? And the sales guys out there might be selling that. I mean, like, why? Wait, time out. The market is trying to, you know, bring more business out and leads an opportunity for something you're already sold out on. And the sales team are trying to close more business with something you already sold out on. You're going to piss off the customer, right? Right. So it's like you have to think about a holistic picture and get the group together. And you can only do that with the analytics and the data, right? You have to know what's going on. And as well as the journey in terms of that analytics. Yeah, I mean, it's having that customer information, you know, you have to talk about the right things to the right people. And that's where these analytics also come in too, right? So nothing's worse than, you know, if I'm on the car market trying to buy a car, all of a sudden, you know, I get an ad for buy a motorcycle. What are you talking about?
You don't
about?
Know your customer and you don't know. Right. You don't know your own business at that point. Yeah. And I think that's, you said know the customer. I think you got to know yourself too. You know, I think you have to be honest with who you are as a company and what your strong suits are. And, you know, before you go out there and just start throwing things against the wall and see what sticks. I mean, that's, you know, that can be a very bad approach sometimes. But, you know, one thing I wanted to ask you too is that, so through this podcast, you know, I've had to try to market myself and promote this, and it's not my comfort zone because I don't like self-promotion. I didn't do this because I wanted to, you know, become a famous podcaster. I just wanted to try something kind of outside of my comfort zone, you know. And but when I, you know, I put different stuff out on LinkedIn or social media or whatever, I'm always surprised how some things take off where other things don't. And I feel like you can do all the analytics you want. You can say, okay, what's the best time to put this out? What's the best message to meet the most people? But then sometimes it's just like luck. Sometimes it's just like, I'll give you an example. It was like mid-September. I was back in our Philadelphia office for the first time since March. You know, I had spent time in our Cherry Hill office when we were allowed to reopen in mid-June. But I went into Philly. And I got up on the 25th floor. I snapped a picture of the Ben Franklin Parkway. And I put a message out there on LinkedIn, you know, basically, hey, you know, we're back. This is exciting. First time back in Philly since then. Thanks some people I worked with. And this thing took off. It got like 25,000 views. It got like, you know, hundreds of reactions. And usually when I post stuff, I'll get a few hundred, maybe 1,000, couple thousand here and there for some other things. But it just took off like wildfire. And I'm like, why? What did I do that struck that chord? And then since then with the podcast, I've had some stuff that really worked well like that. And I've had some stuff that like, I'm like, I'm super proud of this episode, but then I put it out and it doesn't ring true with people. So I'm curious from your perspective, do you ever experience that in your marketing efforts where, like, you say you have a fantastic campaign, super proud of it, you roll it out, and just for some reason it doesn't hit, whereas something you think is like, eh, I'm not sure about this, kind of takes off like wildfire.
Yeah, and it is a hit or miss, right? But what we can do is think about, just do the best practice, apply the best practice to it. I'm sure that one, the one that you talk about, the Ben Franklin Bridge, I mean, anything before that, did you even post a picture? Or was it just
usually it was just text or share something? Yeah, I mean, I took a beautiful picture of the Ben Franklin Parkway overlooking the art museum. So that was probably the main thing.
Yeah. And it's, you know, human in nature, we're very visual people. Right. I mean, look at on LinkedIn. I mean, you can scour the LinkedIn on the feed that you look at, but I guarantee the feed that you're going to stop and pause is if something is in motion, something's moving. Like, there's a visual aspect of it, right? So I would say the visual aspect is absolutely, you know, a key. I mean, we moved on even from just flat pictures, right? I mean, is there a slight animation to it? I mean, by no means will give me like a 60 second, you know, or 5 minute video either. Right. So I think people's attention has gotten shorter and shorter, and during COVID, it gets even more shorter with the amount of, you know, content that's being dished out on. I mean, it's really more around the relevance, right? I mean, you have to be interested in something to do it. And there's now the beauty of a lot of these things in the behind the scene I see is you can do a lot of hyper targeting, you know, when you do a lot of these campaigns, right? The interest, and depending on what that, all that is available to actually try to talk to the audience that really has interest in it versus everybody, right? So, but for you, it's around content, right? I mean, content is the key, right? How much you dish out on that content. Is it a weekly thing? Is it a monthly thing? Or is it, you know, every other month? I mean, the more content you produce, the more, you know, you're going to get a lot more viewers and listeners, right? So it is just that. And I always talk about earned media versus paid media. And this is your standard marketing stuff right here, right? You got your, you know, you got your paid media, right? That's you're paying to kind of get you visible, right? And then you got the earned media, which is kind of where the sweet spot is. It's like the Amazon, right? And you go shopping on Amazon. I look at the product. First thing I'm going to do is look at the review. And then look at the review and say, all right, tell me all the bad review and tell me all the good reviews, right? In that order. But it's the others talking about that product, right? On that product page is all the stuff all about it, you know, all the features, all the benefits, all the great stuff. Great, 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 great. But, you know, that's the earned media. The earned media is about the reviewers, right? And talking about it. So it's like me pushing out, you know, on my LinkedIn page about your podcast, right? And how great it is, right? That's the earned media. You got other people reposting, resharing for you, right? That's going to compound a lot bigger, and it's going to, you're going to have a lot more yield, and probably a lot at the same time, you're probably going to have a lot more loyal listeners along the way.
Yeah. That's, that's the interesting part of it too. So, to kind of see that, like, you know, the, maybe you have some episodes that don't hit the way you want them to, but then you have people that you realize, oh man, a bunch of people are going back to the first one and the second one. And even though I'm on number eight now, so it's been an interesting journey. And, you know, I just want to congratulate you too, because you just became the head of marketing for the No Code Podcast.
There you go. You pick my brain. And are you only on Spotify?
No, is that the only place you're on? But it's, I hope you're okay with it, because it's an unpaid position for now. But
I got a lot of unpaid position, like we all do.
Exactly. I can pay you in fine wines, fine Italian wines. I can send them to your house if you want.
There you go. We'll just have a drink together post-COVID era for sure. I'm looking forward to that, you know. But yeah, I mean, I would say absolutely pick my brain. I mean, I'm here again to help others. If I can help you to get this podcast even, you know, from ground up, you know, pick my brain. Let's have a chat about it for sure. But I also want to do a little plug-in on, you know, if you want to invite me to other future podcasts, you know, I have this, I think you had a podcast before earlier that wrote Sean a book.
KPMG and / Awkward Networker. Yep.
Listen to that. I was like, man, this is great stuff. I was like, I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, I would love to write a book myself, but, you know, and I always talk about this one topic around, you know, on vacation is a theme, right? And there's so much to talk about that on vacation. And the people who do know me personally, they all, you know, we always have an inside joke. I was like, yeah, Min's on vacation. I'm forever on vacation. And I leave that little nugget there for any potential future podcast. And if anybody, any other listener wants to hear that story, definitely, you know, subscribe, you know, listen to Tony and listen to all his podcasts and help his, you know, viewership go up. And if we see these numbers go up, you know, Tony, invite me back in. We'll talk about that journey.
You've got an open invitation to come back whenever you want. Okay. Okay. That's a rare invitation. Only one other guy has that so far. So you're number two on the open invitation list. You just call me when you want to be on.
Sorry. Awesome.
Yeah, you got it. Appreciate it. I think we both have some other meetings and calls coming up in a couple minutes here. So I think we can wrap it. Just once again for everybody, philabundance.org, Team Park Train. You know, get on the train. We'll post the link. It's a great cause. It's all culminating an event at the Navy Yard on December 12th. Min and his team have been unbelievable in raising funds for this cause. Super important. 1 in 5 in the Philadelphia region suffer from hunger, which is, in my mind, unacceptable in the world we live in today, even during COVID. I mean, it was this high before COVID, and it's gotten worse. So we need to come together as, you know, responsible citizens of the world and help these people out. So please do. Anything else from you, Min, on that front? Or any parting words?
No, you nailed it. You nailed it. So yes, hop on the park train with us together and take the journey together.
Please
with Tony
do.
And I.
Please do. Min, thank you so much. Your story is amazing. I hope people really enjoy it, and look forward to seeing you out at the event and talking again soon. All right, Min.
Sounds great. Have a good one.
Thanks for listening, everyone.